So I'm giving this presentation on behalf of Dan Mobius-Clune, the senior author, and Bianca Mobius-Clune, and they were not able to come here for, in a way, good reasons. Bianca has been hired to lead the new NRCS Soil Health Division, and they're packing up their house and are ready to move to Washington, so I'm giving this on their behalf. It's mostly an update on our soil health work. As you probably know, there's now a lot of momentum gaining around soil health, which is very exciting for those of us who have been working in this area. There's a recognition that we need to really move beyond nutrient limitations. If you went to the keynote address at the Soil Science Breakfast, you got a lot of indoctrination on that particular issue. So we're looking at beyond chemical functioning, we're looking at biological especially, and also physical functioning of the soil related to some of these concerns about drought and extreme rainfall, quality, yield, expensive inputs, especially with declining grain prices. We need to understand the ecosystem functioning and the interconnected parts, and we need to identify and understand the constraints and manage them more explicitly. So in case you're not aware of this, I was mentioning the momentum. One of the new initiatives from the past year is the Soil Renaissance initiative funded by the Noble Foundation and the Farm Foundation. Very exciting. You can see the emphasis being on measurement, economics, education, and research, really quite comprehensive. And then there's the Soil Health Partnership, which has been initiated by the National Corn Growers Association with support from Monsanto and the Walton Family Foundation. So if you're interested, please check out their website. It's really these are major initiatives, I would say. Of course, the USDA strategic plan for the next 5 years also highlights soil health, which has, among other things, resulted in this new soil health division within the NRCS, and I believe there is going to be 20 staff being hired into this new division. So, and when the NRCS gets involved, things really start to move. So it's very exciting. So at Cornell, we have, for the past decade or so, we've focused on soil health testing, or an assessment framework, I should really say. And the idea is really to go beyond typical nutrient and pH testing or chemical testing, and to really start to look at the physical and the biological properties of the soil, with the understanding that if you don't quantify it, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. Okay, and when we think about the successes of traditional soil testing, they have been very impressive. I mean, the vast majority of farmers use soil testing. They know how to interpret the reports, and they know how to act on that. So we need to move that into the physical and biological realm. Just to illustrate that, here's there are two pictures. The soil on the right, it's both from New Hampshire. The soil on the right is, by the traditional soil testing, is a better soil than the soil on the left. And because if you only focus on the nutrient content of that soil, then you might come to a conclusion like that. But as you might imagine, the soil on the left has much more favorable physical and biological characteristics. So our soil health assessment framework is built around a test that includes physical, biological, and chemical properties. And so it measures 16 indicators that represent agronomically important processes, and I'll come back to that. We did sort of add these onto a standard nutrient test. So we just took the standard Cornell nutrient test, and then we added to those physical and biological indicators. And we interpret those numbers using scoring functions. It's been presented in the past, but I'd be happy to discuss it in further detail. But on the right, you see a soil health test report, and the indicators are basically four physical indicators: available water capacity, surface hardness, and subsurface hardness. Both of those are measured in the field with a penetrometer. Then aggregate stability, organic matter, citrate extractable, soil protein, root pathogen pressure, respiration, active carbon, and then the more standard chemical indicators. So we use scoring functions, as I mentioned, and then we use this sort of the green, yellow, red traffic light system to sort of indicate where there might be constraints, and then we list those constraints so that people have an understanding of what the problem is. But there's a broader interpretation framework that I'll discuss in a minute. What's maybe striking about this particular soil health test report is where the green and where the red and the yellow is. And so this kind of confirms that most farmers know how to manage the nutrients very well. They've been doing soil testing, and they've corrected their pH and made sure that their P and K and all that were optimal. But in many cases, the physical and the biological properties were suboptimal. So what you see on the right is this heat map, basically. That's a report of about 230 of those samples. And you can see that most of the green is at the bottom, which is where the nutrient analysis is and the pH. And you see more of the red and the yellow with the physical and the biological indicators. So we need to pay attention to that, and that's where we need to make sure that we focus our measurements and our management. So we focused the selection of indicators to represent the major processes in the soil. So we wanted to basically make sure that all the major processes like aeration, water transmission, root proliferation, nitrogen release, pathogen suppression, and all those things were represented by at least one of those indicators. And that's basically how we came up with these with this set of indicators. And this has been published quite a few years ago. What we've done in the past year is we've added two new biological indicators, the citrate extractable soil protein index and respiration, that I'll discuss in a little bit more detail. And we actually took out one, which was the potentially mineralizable nitrogen, which we found slightly less useful. So I won't discuss the physical indicators in much detail, but I'm going to focus a little bit more on these biological indicators. And I should say here that our collaborator biologist is sitting in the back, Janice Thies, and if you have any questions about those particular procedures, she can probably answer them better than I do, because I'm more on the physical end. But we consider organic matter actually sort of both physical and biological indicator. You know why total organic matter is important. You can see the bullet points. So the protein content is then a new addition, focusing on the organic end pool and the turnover of basically plant residues and microbial biomass. The respiration measurement is a little bit more traditional. As you know, Solvita is basically a respiration test as well. Active carbon has been around. Ray Weil did a lot of work on that at the University of Maryland, which kind of focuses on the fraction of the soil carbon that's perceived to be more labile. And the pathogen pressure really focuses on issues around rotations and suppression of pathogens, which is basically a bioassay. So why protein? It's a very important component of the total composition of organic matter in the soil and of residues, and depolymerization of protein is an important component of the nitrogen availability. So they are perhaps the most interesting component of the organic matter component, and we felt that was worthy of specific assessment. So we use a procedure that Dan worked on in Janice's lab, the citrate extractable soil protein. It's a procedure that we can implement through batch processing at relatively low cost, because one of our objectives is to keep the cost of the test within bounds. Very few farmers want to pay $250 for a soil health test. Why measure respiration? Well, as you know, it's a measure of the metabolic activity of the soil system, and it's important functionally for the reasons that you see here. Cycles nutrients out of the organic matter pool, solubilization and transport, most end transformation. So again, that kind of links it back to the soil proteins and the breakdown of incorporated residues. In general, high respiration rates are favorable if there's also a steady supply of organic matter. Soil biological activity influences key physical characteristics, of course, which is where I'm coming from, you know, aggregate stability and organic matter accumulation. So we're using a fairly simple alkali trap respirometer, which is basically a mason jar. It's a fairly inexpensive procedure, and again, so that we can keep the cost down. This is really, in a way, very simple to the Solvita test, which has been commercialized. So we do the testing, but then you get numbers, and you can interpret those numbers, but how do you really use those to improve your management? So one of the challenges that we found was that we gave farmers and consultants these soil health test reports, and they didn't quite know what to do with it. So what we decided is we need to sort of have a planning process, as you see, for example, with a lot of the NRCS programs, where you go through a number of steps, of which the soil health test is one, and you need to help your client basically come to some management decisions. So it starts with, you know, collecting some data on the farm background and management history so that you can interpret the results. You set goals, and you take samples, you submit those. For each management unit, you identify and explain the constraints. So you use the test to see where are the problems. So where do we see red, where do we see green, and focus on the red. Identify feasible management options, and I'll explain that to you in a little bit more detail, and then create soil health management plans. And we suggest that there's some shorter term and some longer term management plans, because some practices will give you more immediate results and some are more long term. For example, no-till gives you more long term benefits, but a cover crop may give you short term benefits. And then you implement, monitor, and adapt, and you kind of have a cycle where you go back and you maybe 5 years later or so, you will do another test. So let's talk a little bit about the reporting. So again, here is that that list. So it provides also. Let me go back. We provide this particular report in terms of the test report, but the complete report is about 8 pages. So we provide background on the processes and indicators. So we explain, for example, how aggregate stability relates to these processes of infiltration and water transmission and rooting and all that, so that you provide a very comprehensive piece of information. And then we explain the results beyond just giving the colors, and then we move the consultant or the farmer towards management practices. So this is just an example of a piece of such a report that focuses on aggregate stability, so just one of the indicators. So as you can see, we just basically state what it is and why it's important. Okay, aggregate stability is a measure of how well soil aggregates or crumbs hold together, blah, blah, blah. So that there's this full information. And then we relate it to the report. So at the bottom you see your measured aggregate stability value is 22.5%, corresponding with a score of 26. And then, so that's a low value, so we then suggest, well, you should probably give this some priority. So we help the recipient sort of work through that process. Then for each of those indicators, we have a set of suggested management practices, either long-term or short-term. So for example, with aggregate stability, you might suggest to incorporate fresh organic materials, okay, maybe a cover crop or something like that. For the short term, but for the long term, we would maybe suggest reducing tillage or using more surface mulch. So these are sort of explicit recommendations. But keep in mind that sometimes the different indicators or different constraints may have the same management solutions. So the challenge is to kind of put those together. And that's what's different from a traditional soil test, where you maybe have a P deficiency or a K deficiency, and you can simply say, add phosphorus fertilizer or add potassium fertilizer or add lime or anything like that. So it's a little bit more complicated. That's why you need to help the user sort of, you know, you help me to guide him through the woods a little bit. So that's sort of the approach. And we'd be happy to share some of those results with you. Again, it's about an 8-page report, because now everything goes electronic. You're not as much constrained by paper, where you say, oh, 8 pages, we're using a lot of paper. We can just send this out electronically. So just briefly, because it does come up quite a bit, there's a lot of interest in soil health testing, and there is another test out there, the Haney soil nutrient tool. I just wanted to point out where they are different, and they are actually quite complementary from my perspective. So, but there's controversy about this. The Cornell soil health test does have these four physical indicators, which is not part of the Haney test. So the Haney test is more of a nutrient and biological indicators. We have physical and biological and nutrient indicators. So ours is a little bit more comprehensive, a little bit more expensive for that matter too. We focus on identifying biological constraints, while the Haney test focuses more on different, some overlapping biological constraints. For example, they use a respiration assay as part of that. We do not use our test to give specific recommendations on nutrients, while the Haney test, at least in some cases, is being used for that. It's up to the user whether they want to do that. And I think that there's some controversy around that. And then we have various management guidelines, as I explained. So it's a more of an assessment framework that tries to guide a user to management practices. And the Haney test does that as well, although in a slightly different way. But they, from my perspective, are actually quite complementary. Just wanted to close by, what's important is that if you go through this whole exercise, you want to be able to get value out of soil health management. And one of the values is that you can increase the efficiency of the use of nitrogen. So a soil that has been invested in terms of soil health, does it give you something in return? And if it basically allows for more efficient nitrogen use and basically allows you to reduce your fertilizer cost, then that's good. So one of the things we're doing is we're linking the soil health test with another tool we developed, which is the AdaptN tool. It's a computational nitrogen decision support tool, and that has just recently been licensed and commercialized. These are the factors that the AdaptN tool uses in making recommendations, and I won't go through all the details. I think most of you will understand that these are relevant, but I wanted to point out under some of the soil properties that we use organic matter content. Simply that. So we're not looking at sort of more labile or non-labile pools. We are handling manure and cover crops separately, but we feel that we can be more granular on the organic matter. So one of the things that we're pursuing is, you see the protein content as it relates to organic matter, and you can see that for a given organic matter content, you can have quite a range in protein content. So the quality of that organic matter can be quite different. And it's actually, the range is about from 5 to 15. So it's a three-order magnitude, not orders of magnitude, a three-factor change. And so the question is, if you have the higher value, higher protein content organic matter, can you then, you will receive more nitrogen from that management system than if you have a lower system, and can we quantify that? So the idea is that currently we're using simply organic matter. We simulate all the environmental conditions, and we estimate mineral nitrogen. Can we now use some of the soil health indicators like respiration rate, soil protein content, active carbon, and maybe some reflectance spectroscopy measurements to do a better job of estimating mineralizable nitrogen? So that's what we're pursuing. Dan's been conducting some greenhouse trials, and we don't have any data to present, but that's I just wanted to point out that that's one of the things that we're pursuing. So thank you very much. These are the folks who have been supporting us, and some of the people who were part of this soil health team at Cornell. So thank you. Any questions?
Coming from a lab approach, a state lab approach, how much does this test cost? How much do you charge the producer to do this?
Yeah, so we've had the test in place since 2006. So we've been doing it for quite a while. We changed the price a little bit. This past year, it was $85 for the comprehensive test. We're going to be doing a little bit of repricing. For example, the root bioassay is something that not everyone is interested in, and is a relatively expensive component of the test. So we're going to be making that an optional feature. But it's about in our environment, so Cornell University environment, which is different than a commercial environment, we can do it sort of under $100 to give you. $85 is what we've been using. It's very comprehensive. You know, you got a lot of indicators, and so we always have this tension between do we insist on being very comprehensive and say this is really what you all need to measure to get a good soil health assessment, versus the desire of the client to pay less money and say, well, maybe I just only want this and that and that. So, but that's about the number. Yeah.
Has your soil health index been built correlated with productivity?
We've done some work on that. Actually, some of it was in Kenya, where we actually found reasonably good correlations between the, because at the bottom we have an overall soil health index, we can correlate that to overall yield. The issue is from our perspective is more on identifying constraints. Okay, so you have say a physical problem related to compaction or aggregate stability, and then you address that particular constraint. But yeah, we do have some data. It's, you know, they're not, you know, R-squared 0.95 type correlations. It's relatively difficult. Dave, you want to add to that?
I'm part of the team, and, you know, one thing we've found is not like we can get yield boost necessarily with a higher soil health score. It's things like farmers telling us nobody else can get in the field because it was so wet and I was able to get it. And I think, you know, following this soil health code, it's not always quite successful.
Sometimes it's reduced inputs too, yeah.
So on the physical properties, for example, the aggregate stability, that looks like fairly intensive in-lab procedure if you're going to try and simulate a rainfall or a rainfall simulator.
Right.
And that's doable within this $100?
Yeah, it's actually not that it's not an expensive component of the test. The aggregate stability probably costs us, you know, certainly under $10. You know, we developed it's a rainfall simulator. That we built. If you know the sprinkle infiltrometer that we sell as well, it's basically based on that. We put the aggregates on sieves and we apply a certain amount of rainfall energy, and then we evaluate the fraction that's stable. And no, that's actually a relatively inexpensive test, and it's a very good indicator. Aggregate stability, if you want to measure only one physical indicator, it would be aggregate stability. It's very well correlated with many other health indicators. Yes?
Is soil texture some other properties used as a baseline for determining, you know, where the range it falls within health within that texture? Because some obvious protection from infection.
Yes. Let me go back. So we actually separately measure soil texture using a fairly rapid procedure, and our scoring functions are based in most cases on soil texture. So you might have a soil texture range. So for fine textured soils, we have one scoring function, for medium another, for coarse textured soils another. So, and we use a kind of a rapid procedure that you know, has a little bit more error than say a hydrometer or a pipette method. But we're not looking at defining the clay content at 43.5%. We just want to make sure we can do it within about plus or minus 2%, and that's good enough for these purposes. Yes?
How is the sampling procedure for your customers that want to test this? Is it the same as for regular soil tests, or is it a composite sample?
Yes, it's a composite sample. You typically use a spade or a shovel rather than a probe, because you want to maintain some of the physical integrity of the soil. If you want the root disease, the pathogen pressure bioassay done, then we suggest that you ship it with an ice pack. That you can actually, you know, we recommend that people ship it in these postal services boxes where you pay $12 and you whatever you can pack into that box, independent of their weight, they will ship it, you know, within the U.S. So the postal service doesn't like that because you can actually for $12 they have to ship very heavy boxes. But yeah, so the we have this all on our website in terms of the sampling procedures. But it's we have the basic the same basic guidelines as regular soil testing, other than don't use a probe, use a shovel. Yeah, and the amounts that we require are a little bit more as well, because we have to separate the soil to all these for all these different indicators. So we require about a liter of soil.
Looking at specifically on the biological indicators, are you working on any recommendations for producers based on those specific biological?
We're only doing general management recommendations. So if your protein level is low, then we make some suggestions, for example, leguminous cover crops or things like that. We're not doing any specific ones. That's in a way what we're working on. But that's it's also a very difficult thing to do. I think that the Haney test, has been criticized for trying to do that, and which is unfortunate, I think, because I think there's a lot of value in that test. But if you really want to make very specific recommendations, especially around nitrogen, that's actually quite complex, and that's where a tool like AdaptN comes in. So we're not getting into that, other than taking the sort of a data mining approach to say, well, we can use some of that information to better predict mineralizable nitrogen, and that can then go into another tool. But if you try to make a recommendation just based on, say, potential mineralizable nitrogen, that's a very tricky thing to do, because nitrogen is very dynamic, as you know.
On the graph you got up there, for example, how many samples are represented across that?
I think it's 234. It's just a lot of samples that came into our lab, just to make the point that if you quantify the soil status and you measure it, then you can manage it a lot better, because we don't see a lot of soils that are constrained in nutrients or pH because the farmers measure it and they correct it. And so we need to do the same thing for biological and physical properties. That's kind of the point. Shannon, did you?
Just as the penetrometer reads are in field, that feed up to the information sheet. If we have infiltration studies,
it's not part of the protocol. We would be very interested in being able to, say, correlate soil health test results like aggregate stability with in-field infiltration measurements. That would be very valuable from a research perspective, because if we can prove that there truly is a strong correlation, that would, add to the value of the tool. And by the way, we have an extensive manual, a soil health training manual, which is now going to be in its third edition. And that gives all the background on the sampling and the individual measurement methodologies and all that, and the interpretation. So please go to, if you just Google Cornell Soil Health, you'll get there.
Well, how often would one recommend doing the follow-up test? Is that a 5-year, a 10-year, to see if we're improving in the process?
That's up to the user. The first step is really to identify those constraints. And depending on the management practices you adopt, you may want to wait a few years. And, the test is also relatively expensive. So if you say changing a tillage system, you don't necessarily expect measurable results within a year. So you'd probably wait. So I would say 3 to 5 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. As I alluded to a little bit earlier, we initially thought by just giving people test results that they would know what to do with that, and so that's why we really developed the process. I think it's especially great opportunity for consultants to work with farmers, or maybe even agency personnel, because I think you need to be able to interpret the results and put them into a management context. Things even as simple as, you know, what's the farmer's attitude towards change? If you get a farmer who always wants to be at the leading edge, and soil health is a great priority to them, they're going to be willing to be much more innovative. On the other end of the spectrum, you may have a very conservative individual who you can maybe convince to change one practice. And so you have to sort of account for those differences. And it's something that did not play itself out as much with the traditional nutrient testing, but with soil health testing, because it's a more holistic approach. We always, you know, when we talk to farmers and consultants, you can always relate it back to human health, because everybody understands human health and how you as an individual address health problems. And it's basically the same idea.
Thank you, Dr. Benes. He's our last speaker today, so I'd like to adjourn the meeting. If there's additional questions, would you be willing to take those?
Absolutely. We'd be happy to.
Thanks for coming.